Okay, good morning, everybody. Everybody listening in to the first meeting that we have in 2017. We have a new board member in our midst, Françoise Floris, formerly very active in IFREG, in NASA. We welcome her on board and look forward to working with her, making use of her vast expertise in accounting, and we wish her well. The first item on the agenda is the post-implementation review of IFRS 13 fair value measurement. Michael?
Thank you. Yes, good morning, everybody. We have a series of papers for you today which summarises and documents the work that we've been doing over the last few months as part of the first phase of the post-implementation review of IFRS 13. We've got a large team here. I should just mention that Ashley Carboni, this is Ashley's first time at the board meeting, so please be kind to her, as usual. The series of papers provides some background to the review, the standard that we're looking at, the outreach that we've been undertaking, and also the scoping exercise for the literature review. We'll take each paper in turn, if we may, and pause for questions or comments from you at the end of each paper, but we don't have specific questions for you until we come to paper E, which is the last paper in the series. So we'll start off, hand over to Ashley for paper 7A.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning, everyone. I would just like to direct your attention to agenda paper 7A, which provides background on IFRS 13 fair value measurement in the post-implementation review. IFRS 13 was published in May 2011 and as a result of a joint project with the FASB. At its issuance, it was largely converged with US GAAP Topic 820, fair value measurement, and the standard has been effective since January 1, 2013. IFRS 13 sets out a definition for fair value measurement as a market-based exit price and provides a framework for measuring fair value. It also requires extensive disclosures about fair value measurements. IFRS 13, however, does not say when items are required to be measured at fair value or when these items should be measured. This comes from other IFRS standards. The PIR is a mandatory requirement that comes from the due process handbook, and the PIR is meant to consider important and contentious issues during the development of a standard or any subsequent issues that may have arisen since its publication. There are two main phases of the PIR. The first phase includes the identification and assessment of the issues, and the second phase includes a public consultation in the form of a request for information, or RFI, and it may also include other consultative activities to gather information. The main changes introduced by IFRS 13 include the application of highest and best use for non-financial assets, the application of the fair value hierarchy, including identification of observable and unobservable inputs, as well as the area of disclosures. Matters that have been discussed since the publication include the unit of account for investments in subsidiaries, joint ventures, and associates, and their fair value measurement when those are quoted. This is also known as the P times Q issue and is summarized in paragraphs 24 and 25 of the paper. Another matter that was raised with this issue was the application of a portfolio exception to a specific example. An exposure draft was published in September 2014, and additional research was conducted in 2015. At the January 2016 board meeting, however, the board decided that it would consider further work on this area if the PIR determined that it was a critical area. So Agenda Paper 7C summarizes the feedback received in this first phase of the PIR on this issue. Another matter relating to fair value measurement, primarily discussed by the Interpretations Committee, is the interaction between IAS 41 and IFRS 13 when valuing biological assets using the residual method. The board decided that this matter would be considered for further review in the PIR, depending on how practice developed. And further details about this feedback and the valuation of biological assets using highest and best use as well is in Agenda Paper 7C. As I have mentioned previously, IFRS 13 was a converged standard with US GAAP Topic 820, and this standard was a revision for FAS 175 and was in effective in December 2011, shortly after its issuance. Paragraph 36 of the paper briefly describes the United States Financial Accounting Foundation's, or the FAB's, PIR process. In March 2014, the FAB completed their PIR and concluded that the standard was meeting its objectives, that it did not result in any unanticipated consequences, and achieved its benefits, its expected benefits. Some stakeholders, however, did raise a concern about the extensive disclosures required in the standard, so the FASB has proposed an accounting standards update in December 2015. Further details on this and other convergence matters are in Agenda Paper 7B, but before handing it over to Mariella to discuss that paper, may I take any questions or comments on this paper?
Hey, Ashley, well done. Very fluid. and cheerful. Okay. Day. Does anybody have any questions? Somebody has to at least invent a question.
May I just?
Yes, Amara.
Just to make her, answer something. It was really an excellent paper, as is the series of papers. Really, really very interesting to read all these feedback, and that you had already gathered around IFRS 13. And your presentation is very clear. Actually, there is nothing in the paper or in your words that I would like, or I feel it's necessary to expand more. Apart from the FAF PIR. Just to be clear, particularly to maybe outsiders, the FAF already concluded back in 2013 the PIR, right?
It was in March 2014 when they publicly released their conclusions on the standard.
And the conclusion is that there is no need to additional work in their standard on fair value.
Yes, but their PIR is a bit different than ours because they look at the cost benefit of an entity would face with the standard, where ours is a bit different where we look at different parts of the stakeholders in the equation. So,
well, that was the bit that I'd like to clarify. They don't go into detail as we do, for instance, in the highest and best use for agriculture.
Yes, and I think it's a bit different as well since this standard has been there for many years in the States. So there, while they were just doing little parts that they may have converged with in 2011. So I know a few other concerns that they had as well were that, the additional costs that audit firms may start increasing because of the fair value valuations and things like that, and also difficulty for private and non-public companies to be able to meet these standards as well. So that's something I believe they are now taking a look at through this proposed accounting standards update.
Okay. Thank you.
I think related to that, we have to keep in mind the U.S. required less fair value measurement than us in some areas. This might be the reasons why, the concern from the constituency are not as strong as us in some areas.
Stephen. In paragraph 16, there's a mention of the June 2010 exposure draft that we had about measurement uncertainty. And I know we never went ahead with that. We had the feedback and we didn't do it.
Yeah.
I'm struggling to remember it so long ago now, but was that a joint proposal with the FASB? And I presume they didn't go ahead with it either if it was a joint proposal?
I think it was joint, yes. Certainly I remember we did outreach together at the same time, and they decided not to proceed on the basis of the cost.
I couldn't find anywhere else in the papers much of a reference to this. I always really liked this.
Right.
And 7 years have gone now, things have changed.
Yeah.
I'd like us to re-examine this issue as part of this PIR,
yeah,
and have another look at why we rejected it.
Yeah. Stephen, can you?
So what
was the issue?
So the disclosure requirement in the standard is about sensitivity analysis.
Yeah.
So what would happen to fair value if you change this variable? Measurement uncertainty analysis was trying to get more at the fact that a level three measurement fair value, there's a range of possible numbers that you could come up with. And this was to try and get more directly at the uncertainty around the fair value measurement, which I think is much more useful than the sensitivity analysis that we effectively replaced it with.
I think that back when we published this ED, the responses that we got were that a pushback from especially some preparers on this ED and on these proposals. And as a result of this, we limit the disclosure requirements just to be a narrative description of the sensitivity of changes in significant and observable inputs in the fair value measurements, but only for non-financial items. So we just limited the disclosure requirement to be a narrative description and not to provide quantitative information on that disclosure. So that was the result of this.
But we now have a lot of experience with this. People have seen how that alternative has worked, and I think we should have a look at when we're evaluating that, we should do it in the context of this original proposal and whether some of the reasons we rejected it are now still valid.
Would certainly be useful if we leave P times Q.
Well, it's not really a P, it's not a P type, this is level three.
Yeah, that would be level
because
two.
Several investors have expressed similar views to yours, as you know, when we come to paper 7C discussing the feedback, and this is, you will see, this is one of the reasons why we are really recommending that the board takes a deeper look at disclosures, and this would be part of that.
Good. Well, I couldn't really see it. It was very clear that measurement uncertainty was going to be part of that review of disclosure, so I just wanted to make sure that I highlighted it.
Sue?
I agree with what Steve says, and I can hear the sort of nervousness in the staff's voices, and I understand why, because it's been a very complicated area and we get very different views between preparers and users, and I think one of the things that's difficult when you talk to users, I think it's pretty clear they all want some more information on level three because it's where the numbers are softer and it's where they're most nervous. But it's hard to get a clear articulation of what form that could be in that would be digestible because it would be condensed enough without being so condensed that it's meaningless. And so, but I think it doesn't mean we shouldn't give up. I certainly think it's an area we need to look at because I think it feeds into the whole reticence of people having us use fair value measurement because they're scared about the numbers, and the more we can get them more confident with the numbers, I think the more we can take pressure off that. And I think one interesting thing, just to peek forward just for a second to 7B, was one of the clarifications that the FASB have made, which is to make it clear that when we talk about when they talk about sensitivities, they mean a description of the uncertainty of the measurement as at the reporting date, because I think it struck me when we had the CMAQ meeting, some people were really talking about sort of what-if scenarios. So if the world looked like this or like that, what would the fair value be? And that's not what we're talking about. Yeah. We're talking about as at the reporting date, you had to think of a range of estimates and you had to choose a number.
Yeah.
But tell us more about the range and what the thinking was. And if we could hone in on that a little bit, even that might help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking about another paper, right?
I was trying not to, but yeah. The staff will get upset with us if we're not careful.
Now, about Steve's comment, I have to add. Firstly, the decision was made, I still remember, in November, one of the meetings, and as to whether we need to do so, I think we have to keep in mind, you know, there is a sections, particularly to the disclosure, users and the preparers have such a strong opposite views. I would feel that we have to be very careful.
Okay. So we can continue with the 7B?
Right. Yes, agenda paper 7B.
Well, as Ashley was pointing out, the fair value measurement project was a joint project between us and the FASB, and it finalized with the issuance of IFRS 13 and the amendments to Topic 820 back in May 2011. And as a result of this joint effort, fair value now has the same meaning in IFRS literature and in US GAAP, and the framework for measuring fair value and the disclosures related to fair value measurements are largely the same. So what this paper does, it analyzes whether the level of convergence that we achieved in 2011 has been challenged by subsequent standard setting work that the boards, FASB and AS, have undertaken subsequently. And the paper starts with analyzing what were the differences that we had back in 2011. And those differences were limited to a very small number of items. They are described in paragraph 8 of the paper. And subsequent to that, what we have done is we have focused the analysis on the work that each of the boards have undertaken since the issuance of the standards. And if we start with our works on fair value measurements since 2011, we can conclude that none of the work streams that we have carried out have resulted in amendments to the standard that would challenge the level of convergence achieved back in 2011. We have done some amendments to IFRS 13 as a result of annual improvements, but those amendments aim to clarify the original requirements rather than changing them. So from our side, we haven't changed the standard dramatically at all. From the FASB side, what they've done some amendments in three different areas, and those amendments are coming from their technical corrections and improvements process. And one of those amendments aimed to clarify disclosure requirements for non-recurring fair value measurements, and this clarification states that those disclosures should reflect the fair value at the relevant measurement date rather than at the end of the reporting period. And this is basically amending a specific disclosure paragraph in IFRS 13. Another amendment that they've done is to reinforce a converged requirement about dealing with changes in valuations techniques. And what they aimed necessary to be amended in that paragraph is to state that when we have changes from pricing conventions to a valuation technique, those changes should also be considered as being changes in valuation techniques. And the third amendment they've done is amendments to clarify in different converged paragraphs of standards of Topic 820 the difference between the use of the terms valuation approach and valuation technique. Apart from these three amendments, there's nothing else that has resulted in changes in Topic 820. What they've done as well, and this is something that Ashley was discussing before in her paper, is they have undertaken work on fair value measurement disclosures. And what they've done is they published an exposure draft in December 2015, and this exposure draft forms part of their disclosure framework project, but of course as well, it aims to address concerns or feedback received during their post-implementation review of Topic 820. And as a result of addressing those inputs, what they've done in the ED is proposing to remove or clarify some disclosure requirements, and in some other cases to add some additional disclosure requirements. The FASB staff presented their comment letter analysis, a summary of the comments received in June 2016, and as you can imagine, respondents were largely in favor of removals and clarifications, and they were skeptical about disclosures being proposed to be added. And what we have learned recently is that the FASB aims to hold roundtables about their work that they've done on these topical reviews of different items within their disclosure project framework. Fair value measurement disclosures is one, but they've also done some work on defined benefit plans, on income taxes and inventory, and they are planning to hold roundtables to gather further input from investors on the 17th of March. To summarize then and to conclude, on the basis of the work that we have undertaken in this paper, we think that the level of convergence right now and the work that we have been doing here in London and back there by the FASB do not represent challenges to the level of conversions that we achieved back in 2011.
Sure.
Thanks, Mariella. The proposal that they have in paragraph that's set out, in paragraph 13C1, with additional disclosures around unrealised gains and losses and what sort of level it is in the hierarchy.
Yes, yeah, it is easy.
Yeah. I see that this is one of the things they're going to do further outreach with investors. Yeah. I think it'll be interesting for us to keep an eye on, because that would seem to be very closely aligned with some of the concerns we hear from time to time about unrealised gains and losses in P&L. And I think it'll be good for us to keep an eye on that and decide whether or not it's something we should think about as well. The other thing is, I always worry when amendments are made to standards, not worry, but presumably when they make wording changes, they think there's going to be a consequence, and it's hard for me to assess how big the consequence is and therefore what the effect is on the converged outcome. So if it's possible, when we're talking to people during the PIR, I'd be interested to understand whether there's really much consequence of the change that was made and that we've set out in 17A1, which is this confirmation from their side that the fair value measurement just is the number when you last measured it, which might not be the reporting date, just how big a deal is that? And also these wording changes that were made about valuation approaches and techniques sort of sound innocuous on the surface, but they must have thought it was important enough to make a change. So I think I'd also be interested for us to get a bit of a feel for whether those changes really matter and whether it's something we should be thinking about as we go along as well. Thank you.
Chung Wu.
Thank you. May I ask you a question, General Steve? In the previous discussion, you suggested whether we include the measurement uncertainty, that issue on observable input. So what I'm saying is on this proposals of the FASB responding there, you know, PIR. So as Mariella explained, that there are some proposals in paragraph 13. It was very, very summarized there. What I'm asking is, do you have a similar idea whether we should include this kind of proposals as some issues in our PIR, like a measurement uncertainty? In the previous discussion,
I certainly think we should look at what the FASB are doing, absolutely, and we can learn from that, and we should look at what they eventually decide to do. That's fine. What I'm saying is that in our PIR, we want to look at what we have done and how that's worked out. I'd just like us to look at what we decided not to do and whether perhaps we should have done it, or whether circumstances now might permit us to revisit. That's all.
Okay, there one more question. Maybe this is a kind of a difference between their PIR and our PIR will be. So this is one difference of the FASB's. They are different from ours. Mm. Another thing is we have something like HBU and the P times Q and something. But those issues were not raised in the FASB with the PIR. So you explained why in the US those issues are not a big issues on the IFRS 13. So could you explain? I have heard already about your investigation on that kind of a background, why these differences exist between the PIR, their PIR, our future PIR. So could you explain a little more?
Would you like to discuss this maybe in the context of 7C and 7E? Because maybe we can say,
Right. Okay,
we have identified these items, and why do we think maybe those were not maybe identified in the post-implementation review of FASB? We could maybe liaise this at that moment, or I don't know whether.
All right.
Mary.
Two things, neither big. One is one of the changes that Sue referred to, the clarification that's discussed on page 9, in paragraph 12A, 12B, about the difference between an approach and a technique when applying the standard. It's ringing bells for me with our project on changes in estimates versus changes in accounting policy. And so just a caution to make sure that, because we put it in that bucket, that we remember to think about it in respect of this project and just connect the dots there. The other thing is a general observation that given that this was one of the convergence projects, the MOU, and given that it was one where both boards concluded that we'd substantially achieved convergence, I think it's very helpful to pause when we're working on something and collect all the thoughts in this way that says, okay, where did we start out and have we gone, just so we have that as an input, and that this was a very good way of doing that. So thanks for that.
Going back to paragraph 13C1 that Sue mentioned, and this has the proposal to disclose unrealized gains and losses. This is something that I think we've thought about before from a disclosure perspective. I'm not sure if it ever come to the board, but it's something that's been banded around because particularly in the UK, some of these complaints about distributable profits and what's realized, what's unrealized. But I thought the challenge was always actually knowing what is an unrealized gain, and it's not obvious how you do that and how it's measured. Have they resolved that problem? I haven't looked at their proposed update, I have to admit, but has that problem been resolved by this?
I think in this EV, the definition or the concepts underlying unrealized versus realized is tackled actually. We can follow up this with PASB staff if there's any other indications or requirements within the broader gap. But it is nothing that I have seen in that ED specifically on that.
From what little I know, and it's very, very little, I think that might be one of the things the preparers have raised in the feedback, the sort of practicalities of actually unpicking that, particularly if you increase the population.
Yeah.
But that's just off the top of my head recollection, so it'd be good for the staff to look at that in more detail. But I think that those are sort of the issues that preparers might have raised.
I mean, it has a lot of attraction, this disclosure, but I know when I've looked at it in the past, it's a very difficult thing to actually do.
Yeah. The feedback that they have received actually on this proposed requirement is that many respondents question the usefulness of the resulting information from the proposed requirement on changes in unrealized gains and losses, actually. So this
we need to be a bit careful with that, though, because I think it would be good. Well, it's interesting to hear that. I think it's good for us to look at what the costs and operational side is from the preparers and what the usefulness is of the information from the investor side.
Yeah.
I'm a bit wary of preparers telling me what's useful information for investors.
I think partially these comments might have arisen because they are proposing to extend this not only to level 3 but to all of the levels. Mm. And probably they see this as a bit too extensive.
And we have heard a fair amount about this in our outreach from the context of existing requirements to make this disclosure for level 3 measurements. And it was interesting observation, and please bear in mind, phase 1 outreach is limited, but observations from some of the investors on this topic was that they also questioned to some extent how useful that is, because they were more interested in the liquidity, and they said the fact that something was actually sold or not sold, which is what they saw as a cut of realized versus unrealized, was not useful there, because they said if you have some instrument that is entirely liquid, it doesn't matter to me if it is realized or not realized, because I know I can realize at any point I want. So it's just, to them, was seen as an arbitrary measure, which was another view. And from preparer's side, we heard pretty much the same as what Mariella has explained as far as BC feedback on additional.
Well, from preparer's side, this is coming from out of the reconciliation of level 3 items. And what they told us is that they don't use this data for running their business. So this is not the data that they use in their current operations, and they have to produce just for compliance purposes.
I think on the user side, if we're looking at this in the PIR, not to preempt the decisions we make later in the meeting, but if we're looking at this in the PIR, it will be useful to talk to some of the investors who have the particular concerns about distributions and unrealized profits, etc., to get their perspective, because I suspect there could be some various camps of users, some who.
And don't forget, there are also a lot of preparers who say, well, you know, long-term investments. It only the value changes of that long-term investment only become truly important for our performance once we realize it. So there's not just there are also preparers who think this is very important, and we could also look at perhaps partial disclosures for specific categories of investments. I think it is important to look to delve into this, and if it is not feasible at all, then that is also important information.
That's just a question for Steve. Steve, is your question about the distinction between realised and unrealised from a distribution perspective or from an operational preparer type perspective?
Well, I don't think we can look at this from a distribution perspective because of all the different legal frameworks.
Exactly.
I mean, it's usefulness to the investors that I was sort of coming at it.
Martin?
Only to caution a little bit, because based on my experience, and many banks, when the accounting standards move to fair value, have also adjusted their system and not really distinguish between what is realized and unrealized, because it was old accounting. And therefore now, I think after maybe 10 years of fair value, now to come back and saying, okay, we have to distinguish between realized and unrealized, maybe for many banks, a little bit difficult and costly. So I would agree, maybe it is kind of information value in it, but only for certain types, I think, of businesses. Because, man, if you in a trading business in a bank, I would question really if it is useful to have this kind of information and cost benefits. And maybe there are situations, but I think we should be careful in really doing that and really be absolutely careful and which kind of investors in which situations they want to have this information.
It just has to be a thorough analysis from both sides.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm just wanting it to be included. I actually think the more useful information is the measurement uncertainty analysis and the liquidity. I mean, those are the two aspects, I think, of level three, which are really important. And the unrealized gain thing is sort of a bit tangential to it. But I'm realistic that maybe we won't end up with measurement uncertainty analysis as much as I like it.
Yeah, but also in this situation, maybe you have a hedge between a level two financial asset and a level three, and maybe there is an unrealized in. And
yeah,
also we can question how useful then, okay, to extract this kind of measurement uncertainty to level three if it is in a hedge relationship. So there are many issues.
Yeah. Gary, yeah, just thank you. And by the way, a very good suite of papers, you know, for this that we're going through this morning. And just a quick view, when you talk about investors and preparers reacting, what do investors need or ask, at least in my experience, and is the problem the investors that are talking to the corporation's investor relations departments or kind of the sell side analysts, they're not necessarily the same investors we're talking to. So I can very easily see why they're talking by each other. We're talking to whether it's the CFA Institute or other, you know, more senior people, but the analysts that follow companies very closely, they tend not to ask these questions. And that's why when you say there's different levels or different strata of investor out there, I think that's what goes on here, is we talk to different investors and the people writing the reports on earnings release date or whatever, and they tend not to ask these questions. I also think, you know, when companies have got portfolios of, you know, level three unrealized gains and losses, and I agree with Hans, companies would find it useful. And I don't know about people like Martin Lee, came from massive books of investments, but I think generally you probably have a rough idea internally of what's in the money and what's underwater. Your measurement might not qualify under our standards, the FASB's might not be auditable, but I think you do tend to have a rough idea of what's a better investment and which one hasn't been trending so well. But not precise enough for purpose of external reporting or even perhaps even to comment on, but kind of order of magnitude, general direction, you know, I think is typically known. If not at the top of the house, at least by the guy that owns that book of business or subsidiary or wherever it's parked.
Okay.
Okay, so we have moved on already, but let's formally move on to paper 7C, which is another information paper. So, and in this paper, we inform you about the outreach we have conducted during phase one of the PIR and the feedback received from the outreach. So, in the period from September until yesterday, actually, we had about 30 outreach meetings with all types of stakeholders, and we have also met with all of the ISB advisory bodies. So in the paper, we have a section that talks about key overall messages from stakeholders, and then there is a separate section that summarizes feedback from each of our advisory bodies. And then a very important part of the paper is what is in Appendix 2, which is the matrix of the topics, that all topics that the stakeholders have brought to us during these different meetings. What I will do is just quickly summarize the main themes, the main messages we have heard. And the first thing that was noticeable for us is that in most of these meetings, the stakeholders have started by commenting that they thought IFRS 13 was a very good standard, and to the point that some of them said they thought it was the best standard ever. I'm not going to comment on preferences of those stakeholders. And they thought generally it worked well. However, also in each of these meetings, we heard a number of comments from people sharing their experience with particular matters that they perhaps found challenging or saw challenging in the application of IFRS 13. And it was quite interesting to see the messages between all these different meetings being fairly consistent, in that pretty much all of them kind of boiled down to four or five topics that were identified and significant. And it was really telling, because our last outreach meeting we had just yesterday with a group of valuation professionals, and it was a quite big group, and people from all over the world participated in this meeting, and they brought to us maybe eight topics and things they discussed, and they hadn't seen our board papers actually. And at the end of the meeting we asked them, so from everything we discussed, which areas did you think are priorities for the board to look at during phase two? And they actually listed the four areas we have in this paper. So the messages have been pretty consistent. And what are those areas? And I mean, Steve has already kicked off the discussion with the rest of you. I mean, one message that was really came across the board was the need to assess the effectiveness of disclosures. And this is one thing that came in every single meeting we had. And as we have already discussed, there are different takes that different stakeholders have taken to this view. So there's overall agreement that effectiveness is a questionable. However, there was a noticeable difference in perspectives in discussions between preparers and investors, which is perhaps not so surprising, in that preparers more of a view that because of usually fair value measurements, instruments that they have measured at fair value are usually very varied and complex, so that they did not disagree that disclosures requirements on individual instruments level were useful. However, what they were saying, once we aggregate this and try to present it on a company-wide level, we end up with such wide ranges that we just cannot see this information being useful, and we struggle with how to make it useful, to the point, you know, some individuals have made that they actually have never seen a useful fair value related disclosures, because often information ends up being boilerplate. However, remedies between two different parties were quite different. Preparers are more interested in just getting rid of these disclosures, whereas perspective from investors was more to look at what needs to be disaggregated and dig deeper. And dig deeper was, you know, in the areas you, Steve, mentioned, it was around sensitivity analysis disclosures and maybe looking at different ways this information can be presented, and generally looking at showing information in a more kind of relevant way for them to make the assessment. They often made comments to us that disclosures were so long that it was very hard to them, unless they were really dedicated and had lots of time, to actually go through it all to discern what is actually there relevant and useful from what is being a boilerplate. So, I mean, the disclosures, so the looking at the matrix, so the points, just to summarize, the main questions we received on the disclosures were around sensitivity analysis, already mentioned by Steve, unrealized gains and losses, which you already discussed. And the third point that came across repeatedly was about usefulness of reconciliation in level three measurements. So I would just pause here to see if there are any questions on the feedback we received on the disclosures, and then I'll hand over to Mariella to talk about P times Q.
So I'm in the appendix and 14B, so it's on page 7. And there's a comment here from the firms about evolving techniques of fair value measurement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And XBA and FBA, okay. KBA.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it says in here, they stated that valuation theory is moving beyond the efficient market theory. I didn't think fair value measurement depended upon markets being efficient. Why did they say that?
Well, they have the feeling or the understanding that the standard is, the foundations of the standard or the theory underlying the standard, the current thoughts and the current valuation processes and methodologies that they are seeing being applied by financial institutions have moved beyond what the foundations of the standards are relying on. So this is the perception of some stakeholders we talked to.
I'm very skeptical about this whole area. Are we going to delve into this FBA, KBA? I've talked to Kumar about it before.
But yeah, we can talk about this, but we were talking about disclosures.
Yeah, so we were just trying to go topic by topic, but we will.
Okay,
we're happy to comment
ahead
on that. Yeah.
I mean, if
we'll be back.
My comments on disclosure.
it was more an observation than a question. Is that okay?
Of course.
The thing that strikes me that I struggle with the most, and I've only been involved in a couple of meetings, so I haven't been in all of the outreach, but I think the thing that I struggled with in the meetings that I was at, and the thing that puzzles me a bit in terms of how we'll do this most effectively going forward, is it's for me it's hard to unpick whether we've got a situation where it's what we've written that's the issue, or whether it's the application of the requirements that's the issue in terms of the quality of the disclosures. So I don't know in my own head, and you may have a better idea because you've spent more time with it, whether it is possible to come up with a useful set of disclosures that meet our requirements. It just is. It is difficult, obviously, and it takes a lot of work and thinking about how to present it, or whether there's something wrong with the way we've written it. That's one of the things I think that we need to sort of get to the bottom of, and also trying to think through creatively ways to facilitate better disclosures, because what struck me in the meetings that I was at, I know there's a lot, and even before we started doing the PIR outreach, you hear a lot when you're out and about outside the building, frustrations with the how burdensome the disclosure requirements are for fair value measurement. But when you talk to investors, I certainly don't get the sense that they'd be comfortable with us to back off a lot of disclosure on level three. So finding some sort of happy medium between what people think is reasonable and what's useful is challenging, and I don't know the extent to which it's a problem with our words, with what we're shooting for is the wrong thing, or whether it's application.
And I think one of the things we want to do as part of this outreach phase is going to be to get down into the detail with people to understand from the preparer or from the investor what is it that their concerns relate to, so that we understand. We've had lots of discussions, but covering obviously the full range of potential topics within the standard. And I think the next phase is an opportunity to really get down on these sort of narrower areas, and disclosure being perhaps the number one area, to understand what is it that investors are saying, or why is it that they're saying that what they're receiving isn't useful and what they think would be useful, and with the preparers, just why is it that they're saying that it's so onerous, and or in circumstances where they have said they don't see the value to investors.
And there is, I think to your observation, Sue, there is probably both factors at play, and at many meetings we have heard people just observing, look, your disclosure requirements are one paragraph that goes in three pages. And many people, especially those kind of in smaller companies with less resources, it's enough for them to see that and they almost immediately give up and say, I can't even comprehend this before starting, whereas in effect, when you understand it properly, perhaps it's not that bad. However, this is not going to solve the problem, and just saying, oh, we're going to redraft to make it, you know, look better, I don't think that is going to be the solution to.
But even in the case where, and I can completely see that because it's difficult to read, but even the case of sophisticated preparers that have got big sophisticated teams who pour through the detail with the best technical advice in the world, I'm not sure that their disclosures have been presented in a way either that's digestible and seems to be useful. So I think partly we could do a better job on drafting, but
there is also the aggregation point, which came up in a number of meetings as well. The fact that when these disclosures are aggregated on a company-wide basis, people are telling us that the result is not giving meaningful information. And so I think we want to try and understand better and think about, well, you know, what would be the answer to that.
I think we're going to have to be quite creative with the outreach materials we use when we talk to investors, because I've been in a couple of meetings with you guys where I think you've asked exactly the right questions, but we don't seem to have got much concrete feedback.
Okay, any other comments?
The second most frequently probably item that we have learned from during all this outreach meeting, I would say that almost in all of the average meetings, this item has been commented upon, is the unit of account and the measurement of credit investments. And the comments that we have received during this first phase are pretty much aligned to the comments that we received back in 2014 and back in 2015 while we were doing the research on this area. So there's nothing major new that we need to report to you during this first phase. It's a corroboration of what we have learned before. If we had to categorize the comments received in a couple of items, I would say like a unit of account and the relevance of the resulting measurement would be the key categories to classify the comments received. On the unit of account, some stakeholders, accounting firms, securities regulators, national standard setters, questioned, for them it's not clear whether the existence of level one inputs overrides the principle of the unit of account of the item that we need to measure at fair value. They think that the proposed measurement on the basis of P times Q would actually represent that level one inputs overrides the principle of the unit of account, and they think that the standard is ambiguous and therefore clarification would be necessary for the stakeholders. In relation to the relevance of the resulting measurement, some stakeholders have referred to us to paragraph 69 of the standard, and some of the requirements of that paragraph point out to control premium and to non-controlling interest discounts as examples of adjustments that the fair value measurements could factor
in order to convey better the features of the investment. And what they see is these requirements being in contradiction to a measurement on the basis of P times Q. Clarification on this area would be greatly appreciated by securities regulators, because it would make the enforcement of this area easier for them. And our securities regulator stated to us that in some instances they have found out that entities applying a valuation technique to measure the fair value of quoted investments, they have done so because they have concluded that the market of their shares was not active. So what this securities regulator is thinking is that the lack of clarity in the standard about the measurement is putting pressure on the assessment of whether a market is active or not, because entities might be using this argument that the market is not active to use a valuation technique instead. What they have told us is that those cases are not frequent, but when they happen, they can be material. And we have received similar comments from quoted cash generating units on the relevance of the measurement of the recoverable amount on the basis of P times Q when it is measured in accordance with fair value less cost of disposal. So similar comments. And again, as well, quoted cash generating units are not prevalent, but when a case occurs, the difference between applying a valuation technique or using P times Q to measure the fair value of the recoverable amount can have a material impact on the impairment test. With that, would be all of the comments that we have received, a summary of the comments we have received on this area.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your analysis. And also, I really like this table, and this table is very useful to know what is the problem. Actually, it may relate to the next paper, which is 7E, the scope of this project. And you are going to say that we are going to tackle the issue of fair value measurement of quoted investment. And I think it's relevant. However, instead, you are saying in this paper, in the column nine, which is unquoted equity investment, and you are not going to tackle this issue because this is outside the scope of IFRS 13. And the reasoning is consideration of the appropriate measurement basis is not within the scope of PIR of IFRS 13. And nobody can disagree with that. So we are not going to discuss what is the proper measurement basis. However, measurement basis issue and the review of IFRS 13 is very much closely interrelated, especially in the issue of P times Q. Then probably there is a different measurement basis for IS 28 and IFRS 9. In the case of IS 28, it is the whole investment, the value in use notion is more important. But when it comes to the IFRS 9, then it should be individual instrument, which there is a market. When there is a market, it's obvious what the price is. But it doesn't really matter whether there is quoted market or not. Even if there isn't any quoted market, even if it's unquoted market, there is a different measurement basis. The similar problem will underline. So therefore, I have a little bit of concern to limit it only to the quoted investment. And also, we should consider the unquoted investment as well. And the thing would be more complicated after the implementation of IFRS 9, because IFRS 9 has a fair value through OCI category, which is just an option. However, this fair value OCI category for equity investment is very, in a sense, tricky, because it has no recycling. So even if you recognize losses in the fair value through OCI, it's just comprehensive income. It wouldn't be kicked back to the profit or loss statement. And therefore, in Japan, 56 companies has already applied IFRS 9. And then the tendency I found is
for the equity investment, they tend to use fair value OCI option, even if it's a unquoted financial equity instrument. The reason is because they have no idea what is real proper fair value prices of unquoted investment. And then if you go down to the fair value through profit or loss, based on such an uncertain measurement, everything, the only the difference goes to profit or loss. And then they are afraid of such an uncertainty. So therefore, they tend to categorize it fair value through OCI, which is slightly different from what we intended for that fair value OCI category. And the other issue I came across was there are cases, some company reclassified from IS 28 to fair value through OCI category. And then notion is when you reclass IS 28 investment to fair value OCI, you should measure it fair value basis and recognize differences, profit or loss. However, because there is no clear idea of fair value of unquoted investment, they tend to use the idea of kind of value in use of investment. And in a sense, do not really recognize big differences between IS 28 investment to IFRS 9 investment. But there is an underlying idea which is quite different. IS 28 is kind of whole investment and the fair value in use. But the IFRS 9 is the individual investment with the market prices. So there must be some differences, but they do not recognize any differences and recognize losses afterwards, after they reclassify to fair value through OCI and revalue it without recognizing it, the profit or loss. So then they could use it as a, you know, escaping from impairment losses. So therefore, lots of issues were coming in after implementation of IFRS 9 in case of fair value through OCI equity investment. So therefore, I don't think we have to widen the issue. We can focus on it. So I will agree with your proposal. However, we have to keep it in mind that the measurement of equity instrument is a very difficult issue. And also we have to consider in the future about the equity method in the future and the interaction with IFRS 9. That is my comment. Thank you.
This issue we tried to solve but failed. And when we finalized the 13, and I remember, you know, Tom Linsman and I clearly said, you know, if we cannot solve unit account issues in this standard, then it seems we actually not reach the final conclusions and the issue will come out. And the issue come out again and again. My question to the staff is, you know, we already felt, you know, the views from the our constituency are so obvious. And most of people will support Martin's dissent opinion, say that you know, the after we conclude the unit account is the group, then, you know, many people will feel, you know, the P times Q is not relevant. The staff say people want us to clarify, you know, with such obvious opposite views there, is there any, you know, the suggestion from our constituency, you know, how to solve this issue? And whether they have any clever ideas to solve it.
What do you expect?
No, this
is a rhetorical question, I think. This is a rhetorical question, probably. But
maybe they got some great ideas about this.
I think some of them, they don't suggest a probable solution, a possible solution on the basis of their views or on the basis of what they believe is a relevant answer. For example, some securities regulators have said that clarity could be provided by stating that even though the unit of account is investment as a whole, if there is a level one inputs, relating to the financial instruments within that investment, then that should be, so basically a clarification of the hierarchy of the principles in IFRS 13, that would be enough for them. So they don't express any views on what is the measurement that they would like those investments to be measured at, but they want clarification, and one of the ways this clarification can be achieved is that in the standard it is clearly stated that even though the unit of account is investment as a whole, because there is this level one input out there, then you should be using them. That's one of the suggestions somehow. That
no, but this is, you know, the views from the regulators,
yeah,
from the verification point of view, and but the other side of the people will say, you know.
We haven't heard, or we haven't gotten any suggestions. We haven't asked either for suggestions to solve this problem. What we heard back in the research that we did in 2015, one of the options could be to measure this using a valuation technique and disclose P times Q, and also disclose any reconciling relevant items between the measurement in the financials and P times Q. So that could be also an option.
You quickly in the question item three, and on highest and best use, and the I appreciate.
We will. Not I'll yet. Come to that.
Okay. I'm sorry. I thought we were in our unit of account.
We were doing P times Q.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And on this topic, just because Shunwu was addressing this question before, I forgot to mention that a couple of thoughts why that item might not have appeared in the implementation review of topic 820. A couple of thoughts only, and this is hypothesis. The SEC has strong views on the approach on P times Q particularly. So that might also have an effect on preparers applying P times Q. And also we know that the US impairment requirements would allow actually to adjust quoted prices of a reporting unit to consider control premiums. So for impairment testing, they don't have this issue either if they had quoted reporting units. So that might be two items that might explain why they don't have this issue in their post-implementation review. Mm-hmm.
Mary?
Oh. Mariella, you might have anticipated the comment or question I was going to ask with that last comment, because one of the things that struck me going through these papers is that the issue we just discussed about the usefulness of disclosures, what could be done, etc., seemed to be a common thread in, you know, what we were hearing in the first stage and what the FAF reported of the PIR of IFRS 13. And this issue about P times Q meets unit of account in particular seems to be unique to us and not to that. So understanding why we're hearing it, and it does not appear that the FAF heard it in respect of application of aligned U.S. GAAP, is something that I would like to factor in as we do this, because at least for some aspects, I think the U.S. has had investment company accounting for longer than we've had the investment entity exception, and so I would expect them to have quite extensive experience, with that issue. You just said it might be the regulator's influence that affects that one, but I think we do have to understand that, because I do grow very concerned that, we keep focusing on the narrow issue. But even from a couple of comments in the papers, as soon as we start talking about the issue, people grab onto it and seek to say, let's revisit all of P times Q as a pervasive issue. And to me, that would be blowing up a major piece of IFRS 13 and really taking an immense piece out of the level of convergence achieved. This unit of account meets P times Q is a much more targeted issue, and I think we do have to address it, but I think we have to be careful about not just starting a lot of people off chasing something that becomes a fundamental re-deliberation of the standard. So, you know, understanding why we're hearing different things from what staff heard about something where we have, I think, common experiences is important.
Stephen.
When we last discussed this, there was some talk about the extent of the difference between P times Q and then the valuation of the investment as a whole. Because, of course, there's nothing stopping companies disclosing that different value at the moment. In fact, I would argue that they should be disclosing it under IAS 1.
Yeah.
So is that going to be part of the research? Has it already been done as part of the research, those disclosures and the extent of the difference?
We haven't done that research during this phase. I think we attempted to do that query when we did the research in 2015, and we couldn't see any additional disclosures being provided in a sample of financial statements. We couldn't see anybody disclosing. Actually, we have P times Q in the financials, but the reasons why this is not a measurement that is reliable is because of this, this, and this.
I remember now. So can we delve into that and find out why? Because if it's such a big issue, and the difference presumably is material if it is a big issue, why is not that number, which obviously some people think is a better number, why on earth isn't it being disclosed? There's nothing stopping the disclosure.
I'm not going to recognize that now.
Not doing P times Q and...
We left it grey because of our project, and that's the problem the securities regulators have got now. I don't think people necessarily are using P times Q anymore because we raised a question about...
But that's only recent. I mean, this...
Yeah.
And this is what we've been hearing, as Sue says, that there is actually growing diversity in practice.
That's why the securities regulators are upset, because I think before they felt they could impose P times Q, and then our project made it more difficult.
Okay.
So, Gary, I've stopped the order just for you, and we will talk about highest and best use next.
Okay.
And this was one of the, you know, we classified as a top priority issue, but it's a little bit different from disclosures and P times Q, which were really overwhelmingly mentioned in most of the meetings. Highest and best use was something that was raised by a select group of stakeholders, and mainly national standard setters, in particular in Asia, and some of the European countries. But what was notable to us is that in some of the other meetings, people were expressly of the view that there was absolutely no problems whatsoever with applying highest and best use concept. So there was a bit of a mixed message there, but from people for whom this was an issue and it was significant, it mainly boiled down to the application of the highest and best use when the asset's current use was considered not to be his highest and best use, and when that asset's use was considered in the group. And then they, in particular, they highlighted the issue they had that they would sometimes, and this would leave them because when applying residual methods to accounting for the other assets in the group, this would lead them to recognize some of the assets in the group as a zero. And just to give you an example to illustrate this, most often we heard this in relation to, for example, farms and farmland, where that farmland is close to the suburbs and the cities, and it is, it has been determined that highest and best use is actually to sell it and convert it to some kind of property development, and the value of the land far exceeded the value of the farm as a business, yet that farm would have some, you know, equipment on the site, or there would be, you know, there's obviously trees or plantations involved. And what they said, sometimes they would end up in circumstances where using the approach and valuing land at the value it could obtain for this development would lead them to value all the other assets that are part of the farm at zero. And this was found to be a very counterintuitive outcome, given that often in these cases they would say the intention would not be to discontinue the current use, and therefore they felt the accounting led them to lead to
conclusions that were not useful. I think with that I will stop, and maybe Gary and just let you comment on this.
You were sort of touching base on exactly what I was thinking of. I mean, it's like, okay, farms and factories versus urban development, and that's a good extreme example. People visualize it. What my question really is, I can't believe that's only specific to the four countries you put here. That seems like that would be a global issue, you know, with that it is opposed to Malaysia, Australia, New Zealand, and France. So I'm wondering, are they here because they're the only places we heard it from? I just got to believe it's a more broader issue than that. And assuming we go forward the PIR on this particular question, I would test, the universality, of it. That's my concern. I think it's a bigger issue than perhaps.
I mean, we did, and you're quite right. And, we did have 30 meetings, so surely we couldn't have covered everything. But it was interesting, for example, at IFS meeting very early on in the outreach where this matter was raised, we used the opportunity of having over 60 national standard setters there, and we asked them, for whom of you is this an issue as far as you were in your jurisdiction? And only those few raised their hands. But this is not to say, again, that there aren't, certainly intend to.
There's also the level of knowledge of the person in the room that you're asking and stuff. Yeah. But taking your example about the farm equipment, actually in some ways valuing it zero, if you're going to assume you're going to value the farmland for urban development, you don't need used farm equipment, and there's probably not a huge market for it. So actually valuing it in nil actually is sort of a consistent application of if I'm going to value the land for sale. And just an observation, we don't have to process it, but it's not an inconsistent. It's inconsistent with how the owner plans to use it, but it's not inconsistent with the valuation assumption or the value of the land for sale. Very well.
Now, I first want to offer my observation, then ask question to the staff. My observation is, this issue was big issue at the beginning. And I remember every time when we went to Hong Kong is an active market, And I went there many times with Wen and others, and the people quite often would not accept this idea. And particularly a few giant companies, they say that we have, retail, we have hotel, and we have harbors, and why we want to highest best use if current use is so, its current use is. We will not change the current use, and the weather, based on highest best use, will provide relevant information. And the reason why I feel, struggling is when we had LSG meeting last year in New Zealand, even Australia and New Zealand raised this issue, and which I never heard. And those are all matured market, Quite often the case, fair value management issue come from underdeveloped market, but this time, again from New Zealand, Australia. My question is, it is not clear for me the issue is scope or issue of technicality. Why I ask the question is because, after the struggling, we add two, aspects in the standards, which in my view already narrow down the scope. Firstly, we add called physically possible, legally permissible, and financially feasible. So with those conditions, you will not subject to fair value management or the highest best use. And secondly, we add 29, we also said, however, an entity's current use of a non-financial assets is presumably be the highest best use. So based on these two paragraphs, I got feeling most of the Hong Kongese companies should not worry about it. So means, we're only a very narrow scope of assets we're subject to highest best use. And alternatively, people say, you know, it is technical issues. So, you know, how to apply it is a big issue rather than scope. It's not so clear for me, you know, from staff's paper. You understand what I want to ask?
Mm-hmm. It is not clear for you. So why, if the standard has so many hurdles to get to highest and best use?
No, it's not clear for me, you know, if the company already used these two paragraphs, they already understand, you know, they will not be subject to highest best use, you know.
Why we still have cases and why we still learn about cases of highest and best use?
I think I was in one of the conversations about this, and in that circumstance, that is an emerging economy. It's a very, very obvious that the highest and best use is not the use that's been put to. So you pass both of those tests because you really do have the ability to use it for something else, but there is an intent to continue using it in the way they're using it. And I think they're objecting not to the economics, they agree with the economics, but to the outcome. That they feel the outcome doesn't represent their intent rather than that the outcome doesn't represent economic reality.
And some of the meetings are, and people object to the sort of sense that it's like an opportunity cost analysis, and they don't agree with that.
Yeah.
So the sort of logic they question.
But it could be very good that the reason we have this raises an issue in relatively few areas, exactly as you mentioned, because others, where it's not so extreme, actually use those provisions and end up with being current use being highest and best use.
So,
I want to see if your memory is better than mine, because I probably should know the answer to this. But the examples that Australia and New Zealand raised, were they public sector or private sector examples?
Australia, public sector, yeah. And also in at the IFAS meeting, the representative of New Zealand said that they have a major use of fair value for PPE. So that might also contribute.
Because it's mandatory, so when IFRS allows fair value or cost, it's actually as you know, to use fair value, so there's more.
So I think that might be the Australian situation,
yeah.
Because it's public sector.
Mm.
I think it brings up some more of the opportunity cost type scenarios, because if I have to operate, I don't know, a school there,
yes.
But it could be a residential development, I can very much see
specialized
why.
Specialized assets,
specialized
prisons,
yeah.
Hospitals. Mm.
Okay, so that leaves us with two more areas to highlight, and I think we touched briefly on them both. One is applicational specific judgments, and this very much goes to judgments required to determine a level of fair value measurement hierarchy, and in particular two things, determination of whether a market is active or not. And this goes back to Mariella's point on P times Q. And I think you already mentioned in the tee-up that determination whether a market is active or not leads you to conclude whether the input from that market can be level one measurement. And therefore, this puts further pressure, the P times Q concerns put further pressure on definition, as you mentioned, because people are actually using then this judgment of where the market is active to try to opt out of P times Q if they feel it doesn't provide relevant information to them. But this is not the only example where this judgment was brought to us. It was really across the board that it was found that it is difficult to make, and not only in emerging economies, as some would think, but even in pretty much everywhere, because the determination of a market is on the level of individual instruments. So even though overall you might have quite more developed financial systems, you still, you know, have to determine that judgment on individual instrument level. So that was one that was perhaps most pervasive, but the other one was also about judgment that is very important for distinction whether instrument is level 2 or level 3. And this is a judgment whether you use unobservable input and whether that unobservable input is significant. Because if you do use significant unobservable input, then your measurement is level 3. And why is that is important is because once you're in level 3, you have to provide much more extensive disclosure requirements. So that also puts pressure
on making this judgment. So in the areas of judgments, I mean, these are the two specific things that we have heard most about people talking and saying that it would require further investigation. I don't know if anybody has anything on judgment, or should I maybe just move on to mention something Tark has already brought up. And this is something that we put in the bucket where fair value is hard. And it's particularly hard when there is no market or there's very limited market. And there were two specific examples consistently being brought to us. One is Tark, you already mentioned, unquoted equity instruments. And the other example is valuation of biological assets. And we have put it in here, we discuss it, as we mentioned in the paper, because consideration of these things is really about not, is about whether to measure at fair value for some, which is not something IFRS 13 does, and is also about a bit how to, which you can argue whether it is accounting domain or whether it belongs to this standard. So we kind of felt it's a little bit out, but we do want to highlight it because it was raised as quite a significant matter by many. And with these two specific examples given in particular. So this concludes our review of most highlighted areas by stakeholders. There were a couple of other things. Steve, I don't know if you want to talk about valuation adjustments now, or you're happy to leave that offline, or if there are any other questions about any other areas that are mentioned in the matrix, in the appendix.
Aida, in relation to C, the judgment, you know, sections, I think another confusing or people's worry, or people may have different view, is in relation to the final decision as a result of financial crisis. You know, together with FSB, you know, we, you know, decide to allow use, you know, market model, you know, when market is not normal, you know, during the crisis and for sale and others, or disordered market, you know. And people use these two conditions, say, you know, you clearly allow market model. And of course, during that time, it's a financial crisis environment. And then people will say, that, you know, use those two benchmark, you know, if market is normal, it abnormal, and then another one is a for sale, you know, maybe to some extent is abnormal market also. Then people will try to say that since it is abnormal, normal, therefore we should not follow, you know, market to market. This is a relation in relation to active or not, you know, I want to point it out.
Well, what they feel in this area is that they need to make judgments about, for example, whether the volume of trading of their shares is have significantly declined or not, or whether they have sufficiently frequent in the trading, and those assessments are found generally to be difficult to come up with. So they think that for their particular shares, maybe they haven't had that many tradings, the volume has not been high, and even though the market as a whole is active, for their specific shares, they don't have much of evidence that the market for their shares is active.
And to your point, Vigo, about market being normal and abnormal, or efficient and inefficient. I mean, we did hear this point from some, and this, I would say, is perhaps more prevalent in emerging markets where, and it doesn't go only to level one, but we have heard arguments of people saying, well, it's not active market, there were some transactions, but the market is so, you know, dysfunctional in their view that they really do not think they should be using market inputs, and they found the other information more. So it is something we heard. I perhaps maybe wouldn't put it in the area of judgment, I'm not sure, but we had kind of few views expressed on this, but much more prevalent was this judgment about market being active is something that was raised by
many as an area that could be troublesome at times.
Now, what I want to point out is this angle is slightly different from active versus not active.
Mm.
It's about whether the market is normal or abnormal. It's because the definition of fair value is based on normal.
Right,
so
orderly transactions.
Yeah, orderly, yes.
Yes.
So slightly different between active versus non-active. And
we haven't heard that many cases of thinking that the price represented not an orderly transaction and therefore should not be considered in the measurement of that investment. So we haven't heard of many cases for which the reason of not applying P times Q was because the transactions were not orderly. So, but that might be the case actually for emerging economies.
Mm.
Stephen?
This whole area of the entity view versus the market view. So people saying markets are dysfunctional, they're inefficient, therefore I want to override the market prices. It gets me very suspicious because in many cases people don't like a fair value and they want something else. And I feel a lot of this is to do with that. And I think we have to be very careful in our investigations. Just coming back, you invited me to respond on the KVA, MVA, FVA, all of. I put these in a similar category of, it makes me very suspicious as to what's going on here, and are we moving away from what I would regard as a sort of a fair value measurement? I don't know enough about it, and you say it's an evolving field. And I do feel it's something that we need to get on top of and really understand and what the implication is for fair value measurement. So I was a little bit, the reason I reacted is I was a little bit concerned when you said low to medium priority.
Well, it depends. So we think like CVA and DVA.
They're fine. I understand those, and that is part of fair value, no question about it.
I think the low and medium was CVA and DVA practice has been more established. And there are not that many concerns that those adjustments are not being included in the measurements. So still there are some divergence in practices, and still corporates, for example, find it difficult to incorporate DVA. But somehow we could assess that the relevance of the concerns were kind of low. But for the others, where there are much more divergence in practice, entities sometimes include them, sometimes no, and the measurements are very diverse and evolving, then it's where we thought, well, probably that area might be worth a medium. So this is more or less,
all right.
Yeah.
Constance?
I have a question related to the areas where the fair value measurements are difficult, so the biological assets and the unquoted equity instruments. And I really read your report as highlighting the fact that people had difficulties in practice in measuring. So I was also therefore surprised that you would say it's not in the scope of the peer. And I would like to understand better if it is not in the scope of the peer of considering these difficulties that are encountered in practice, at what point in time or under what exercise would we consider them?
I was thinking about this before you raised it, because I think that I would agree with the staff that it doesn't feel like it's our PIR per se, because we don't tell people how to do the measurements, we tell them what the objective is, but then very closely associated with the application of our standard is all of these concerns and difficulties around how you do it. And I would agree that sort of doesn't feel like it's our role per se, but I wonder whether we should be thinking about whether we can work with others to try and help in this area. And the people that come to mind are somebody like the IVSC, so not so much us doing anything but encouraging others to assist in providing more materials that people could look at when they're applying our standards, so that, because it feels a bit mean to say to people, we know it's hard but that's not my problem. And I think we might have a bit of a PR issue if we just did that, but I'm not sure that we can solve it out directly, but maybe we need to think creatively about what we might be able to do with others. that wasn't why I had my card up, but that would be my thought, because I think it's a bit harsh to say not my problem. Just on the CVA, the FVAs, KVAs, the XVAs, all of the VAs that seem to get created every week. Mm. Some of these are things like adjustments for regulatory capital and all sorts of stuff. Mm. I think it's a difficult area. It's an area that I must say worries me because the numbers are big. My first concern, though, is I think we need to be super careful in anything that we write not to be seen to be blessing that those adjustments are consistent with an IFRS 13 measurement. And I don't think you've done that per se here, but I think that it worries me a little bit that some people are talking to us sort of with the starting assumption that, you know, this is all fine, this is part of our IFRS 13 measurement, we're just talking to you about technique. And it's only a regulator who's sort of questioned whether it's actually consistent with the fair value measurement in the first place.
What they are saying is that the market is sorting it out, and that the market participants are actually sometimes considering them. And basically, this would be somehow could be somehow framed within the standard.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And I don't think it's enough that the market's doing it, therefore it's okay, because we have specific requirements of our own.
We will.
The biological asset issues I originally intend to discuss in the next paper, since Francois already raised and Sue also responded to it. I personally feel, you know, we should solve this issue. Of course, not from this point. You know, it is when you should use fair value. And I also don't feel it is the question of how to apply. I think there are two aspects. One is whether it is relevant. Another one is how to do it. And it seems, Su Chad said, you know, if people don't know how to do, and we try to ask others to help. My observation is, you know, from many of the Asian countries, you know, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Thailand, and others, including China, and people feel both sides, you know, whether it is useful, plus whether it is, you know, operational. And I tend to feel, you know, the current requirement is too extreme, you know. And we have many standards give options. I would rather prefer in this standard, or no, the biological asset standards, would give a clear option to the our constituency to use it. If you know you have such a market, you can have active, you know, fair value measurement, and you are able to do so. Of course, you can do it. But if not, you know, why, you know, we should not give options? This is my personal view. Of course, it is another project, not this project.
Mary, a general comment that's not specific to any one of the issues, but kind of an overall caution as I've watched us have an hour and a half talking about different subjects that come from the first phase, which is a PIR is not kind of go back and punish ourselves and all of our stakeholders to redo every issue we ever talked about or think about everything that we can find. And I think it's a very difficult balance for the board, but particularly the staff doing outreach, to make sure we achieve this balance of getting a thorough, considered, properly informed assessment without saying, no, really, really, are you sure it's not a problem? Are you sure there's not a problem there? Because this is supposed to be our assessment to say, is there anything that's so significant that we have to go back and make a change for something that we have completed relatively recently, rather than continuing to polish. So I think it's maybe a bit in terms of what we say to the staff, but I think more importantly, it's the signals that we continue to send around PIRs about trying to keep them focused on finding things that really are urgent and warrant significant responses, rather than the most complete capture of every criticism that somebody can bring up, because otherwise we're going to just have the portion of our resources devoted to PIRs mushroom, and it might cause us to fail to address things that in the overall scope of things are more important. So I think it's good that we're doing the kind of soul searching we are now, but I think we then have to stand back and put it in perspective when we think about what we do and how we do it, to keep balance with our overall priorities.
Yes, very short one. I agree with generally with Mary's point. But one thing to ask to Steve, you know, on that valuation adjustment, our step to examine the response of accounting firms and one regulator. However, whether investors are happy with the current measurement of fair value of the derivatives over the counter.
I'm not sure the investors understand what's going on.
But this, it looks like a black box on this derivative issue. This is this reminds me of the big financial crisis 10 years ago. So even though this is a quite complex technical issue, maybe our professional accountants might not be able to deal with these issues. But if investors have some big problem with this valuation, then we need to investigate more.
We should certainly ask investors,
yes.
But if the response is we don't have a problem, I don't think we should stop, because I don't think if there is a problem, I don't think the investors would actually know there is a problem necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to investigate irrespective of whether the investors know there is a problem at the moment or think there's a problem at the moment.
Okay. So. Yes, so before we move on to talk about next steps, I would like to hand over to Maria and Matt to talk about academic scoping review.
So, agenda paper 7B, Matt Billing, Head of the Education, and I are here to present to you the scoping review's main conclusion and results with regard to the academic research on fair value measurement. For the purposes of the first phase of the PIER, we chose a scoping review rather than a systematic literature review to initially map the large and diverse body of academic literature in terms of the volume, the nature, and the characteristics of the research questions that are relevant to the PIER. In other words, we undertook a first screening process to identify any recurrent topics in the academic literature based on published papers pertaining to the broad topic of fair value measurement. We identified common trends rather than undertaking a detailed analysis of every single individual relevant paper to the PIER. A scoping review actually is designed to answer questions like how many academic papers discuss fair value aspects of financial instruments. So how many represents the volume? Financial instruments is the nature of assets and liabilities summed in those papers. And fair value aspects are the set of the mapped characteristics listed in paragraph 15 with regard to the research questions on financial instruments. So for more information on the methodology used for the scoping review, please see paragraphs 9 to 12 and appendix A. The main reason why we chose a scoping review rather than a systematic literature review is that after the broader assessment of the PIER based on the first screening of both academic and non-academic outreach and research, we will be in a better position to identify specific research questions and undertake a focused literature review on these specific questions, of course, with the support of the academic community during the second phase of the PIER. So the main conclusion that can be found in paragraph 4 is that no material issues emerge regarding IFRS 13 specifically, based on the reasoning presented in paragraphs 5 to 7. However, we present three main themes identified in the literature that were either directly or indirectly attributable to IFRS 13. These are listed in paragraph 13 and appendix B and can be summarized as financial instruments analyzed in paragraphs 14 to 16, non-financial assets and liabilities analyzed in paragraphs 17 to 21, and the impact of applying judgment in fair value measurement on audit fees and processes analyzed in paragraphs 22 to 25. So next steps, as previously said, during the second phase of the PIR, we will undertake a systematic literature review focused on specific questions emerging from the broader assessment of the PIR. Do you have any questions?
Questions, observations?
Useful.
Thank you. All clear?
Good. Thank you. Okay, so the final paper. And we have some questions for you here, 7E. And there are three questions in this paper. The first is whether you want to proceed with the PIR now. The next one is what areas would you like to focus the PIR activities on? And the final question is, if you agree with all of the before, what additional activities in addition to full literature review and the request for information would you like the staff and yourselves to conduct? So rather than going one by one, I'm just going to tee up our overall recommendation and then, you know, I'll let you discuss.
Have you already picked up some issues in the preceding conversation?
Well, what I picked up, I think, is that, and this could be a bias, but I see you agreeing with the staff recommendation with a couple of provisions, so I will just tee up staff recommendations and then maybe highlight the things I've picked up from earlier discussions. So we are recommending that we proceed to phase to next phase of the PIR immediately and issue a request for information, albeit we recommend that that request for information and our research activities are focused and focus on the four areas we discussed in the paper 7C. This is assessment of effectiveness of disclosures, then two unit of account related issues, one on P times Q, the other being highest and best use, and the final area being the specific use of judgments, in particular determination of whether market is active and whether there are significant unobservable inputs used in the measurement. So I did not hear objections to that. What I heard in the preceding discussions is questions raised about the fifth area that we were also talking about in this paper, which is fair value is hard, particularly hard where there's limited or no market information, with examples given on unquoted equity instruments and biological assets. As we already discussed, we did not recommend to proceed with that because we thought it was outside the scope of what we're doing here. However, and just elaborating what Sue said, is there could be a facilitating role in education or cooperation with other stakeholders, and I think this would support probably some of the comments we have heard with people, in particular in relation to the biological assets, where they said really we don't have access to much literature, and if you can simply help us by pointing out where evaluation literature in this area exists, you know, in other jurisdictions and how people deal with this, that in itself would be helpful. So that is something to explore if, you know, this is a role, you know, to be conducted here and how that can be done without being seen to endorse such literature that is not discussed or approved by the board. I will just maybe briefly mention for each of these areas what we have done in the paper is we have recommended objectives for the research in phase two. And why we have recommended objectives, this is to help us decide the actual detailed approach to the outreach and the questions and help us decide or recommend additional activities that would best help reach these objectives. And as just a reminder, post-implementation review is a review. It's a basically research exercise. So we are not at the stage now, although we are discussing it, but it's not at the stage now where the board has either decided to take any of these as a standard setting topics, nor deciding about any potential changes, what they look like. We are really gathering evidence to help the board make these decisions in the best possible way. So with that in mind, with regard to disclosures, our proposal is that the objective of the review is to really further delve into this topic of effectiveness, in particular considering differing views of preparers and investors with a view to see how we can try to reconcile those views. And with that in mind, the staff are recommending one on perhaps deeper consultation exercises where we could possibly use case studies or examples where we could really understand some of the concerns being raised, and perhaps that will help us understand this issue better and help us recommend to board how to go forward. With regards to units of account and P times Q, we are proposing that objective is to further assess current practice and understand how widespread are these issues, and this is reflecting the fact that we had somewhat differing feedback on this and mixed reviews, and we felt, and you know, the views about whether there is divergence in practice or not, and we just felt getting a better grip or understanding on this would help you then make a decision whether and if so how to go forward. In relation to judgment, again, our recommendation of the objective is to assess why actually there are these difficulties and try to identify what support might be most helpful. And in relation to highest and best use, our recommendation of the objective is to better understand the issues with this concept, and going back to some of the comments Vago made earlier, and how widespread it is. And this is particularly important given that we had such a mixed feedback on this topic, so to really understand pervasiveness we thought was important. So with that in mind, our recommendation is that in addition to RFI and literature review, we also have outreach to investors and preparers, focusing on disclosures. Of course, we will have the normal outreach as well. Assessment of widespreadness of the particularly P times Q issues and highest and best use issues. So with that, I will
I basically agree with what the staff's recommendations are, and while I remember I like the fact we're calling it a request for information, I don't know if that's what we've done in the past, but I think that's a good articulation of what we're doing, looking for information as opposed to views per se. Just to be picky for a couple of seconds, just in terms of the words we use in terms of what we would focus on, if I may. So the first one on the effectiveness of disclosures, in the question it talks about user and preparer perspectives on effectiveness and how those could be reconciled. I actually preferred the wording that you used in the last sentence of paragraph 37, because to me that was a more clearer articulation of, I think, exactly what we want to understand, which is understanding from preparers and investors what information is costly to prepare and what information is most useful and decision relevant, because I think that's more focused than the question, so I'd prefer that articulation. And on the second one, the fair value measurement of quoted investments, this whole P times Q area, building a little bit on what Steve said when he talked about this, I'm not sure about this, I don't disagree, but I'm not sure if it's the best articulation to talk about trying to find out where it seems not to provide relevant information to investors, because I think we'll just have a whole load of preparers coming back with general observations that it's not relevant information, which won't be that informative for us. I wonder whether it would be better to try and focus in on the difference in measurement you might get between the P times Q types measure and a unit of, you know, a broader unit of account type measure, I don't know what the right words are, but how different the two measures might be and why, so we can get a better picture ourselves on how much it matters and what drives it, which we can then use to understand the relevance of the information, but it's a little bit more specific than just saying, do you think it's relevant or not? I'm not sure that's what you meant, but that might be what people think those words mean.
Françoise?
When we refer to conducting consultations with preparers and users, of course I agree with what you propose, but you seem to limit that to the assessment of the effectiveness of disclosures, and where the issues relate to difficulties that are encountered in practice, I think the consultations with preparers should be extended to cover those, so the difficult judgment and the high and best use, and hopefully, I'm not sure whether you have indeed included the difficult fair value measurements in that area as well.
And certainly we will have comprehensive outreach covering all the areas. I guess, I mean, the reason we highlighted disclosures is we felt in particular with the effectiveness of disclosures, it seemed the most useful way to understand it properly is to have, like, roll up our sleeves and have very focused discussion in this area. And this is not to say that we will not have a separate meeting perhaps with the same stakeholders discussing the others, but we just found, like, we have had quite extensive outreach in the phase one, but it was very difficult to delve into the specifics, and partly because, you know, people maybe don't remember these things from top of their heads, and they would appreciate having an example in front of them that will help them discuss and maybe better articulate their views. So we thought creating that kind of setting, particularly for this, could be helpful, which is why we're highlighting, but, you know, point taken, we will discuss all of these with stakeholders.
Martin.
Yeah, I also agree with the scope of the post-implementation review, but I don't agree that we need further research on this P times Q issue, because I really think we have done sufficient research on that, and I don't really know what we should learn in addition what we not already know. So I think we should not bother really our constituents again with this kind of question, because we have done it for the last 3 or 4 years, and I don't know what we should learn in addition what we currently don't know.
I think Martin has a point there. Errol.
So again, also agree with where we've landed, what the proposals are, what the four that you've proposed. It might be being a little bit picky, but I found paragraphs 14 to 19, which deal with what we're going to ask on the P times Q, quite difficult to figure out. I mean, to my mind, and maybe this is a little bit of what Martin's saying, there are three issues that we've identified in the P times Q that I can think of. It is the diversity in practice. It is the actual outcome that people think we're proposing, which is that you have to apply P times Q in most circumstances. And it is the disconnect between what is happening for unlisted versus listed, that you actually seem to have different valuation objectives. We talk then later about things like pervasiveness, but I'm not sure whether we're talking about pervasiveness of the type of transactions that fall foul of this, or pervasiveness of the diversity in practice, or the pervasiveness of this disconnect type issue. And then I think we seem to tuck right at the very end to the point about worrying about the relevance of the measure. Most of the rest of the focus seems to be pervasiveness. Now, that would seem to suggest that we're actually relatively comfortable that other than diversity, we've got the right answer, which I don't think is what we found in previous stages. So I just think we need to be quite clear on what we are concerned about, what the pervasiveness issue is. To Martin's point, I don't know that we can avoid this issue being the fact that it's the biggest issue in. So we may want to think about whether we include in a PIR a little bit of a summary of what we have previously heard in previous, and just ask people whether they agree with that. So that we sort of build on the research that we previously heard rather than try to reinvent the research. And then on the issue that Francois raised earlier about the biological assets and others, And I agree with where Sue was going with it, but I agree that we should be looking to others to help with, and it's clear that the objective is there. There is one issue that's come through quite a lot in the discussions I've had, which is this issue of how you deal with things that are in process or in production. So something that is not sellable in its current state and needs something else to happen, or something that is directly enclosed within something else. So rubber in a rubber tree or oil in a palm oil, when do you start to recognize the underlying? And I don't know whether that's an issue that people are willfully perhaps understanding at this stage, or whether more clarity is needed in the standard. I think whether or not we ask the question, we're going to get a lot of feedback on that, and we might find that asking a question there helps us get a more direct, more understandable response that we can deal with. So I would have been inclined to put at least something in there around that. I think we've fallen foul of it here, and I think our constituents are going to as well. I think we need to be very clear at least half a dozen times in the document that we are not asking about other standards. It comes out and people fall naturally into the trap. And then the last thing I think, and this comes to Sue's answer to Francois's comment earlier, is I wonder whether we shouldn't be thinking about asking whether people need more educational guidance. Because I think that is the driver of a lot of the issues around things. But I think if we just ignore it, we're going to get it picked up as an issue around the standard instead of an issue around education.
Mary?
Like several of the others who commented, I agree with the four items that the staff has identified as being the focus for the questions and the request for information. And like others, I stumbled over the phrasing of the fair value of quoted investments. If I just read what's on page 11, in question two, it sounds like we're reconsidering a much broader range of issues. We had kind of parked the issue we had in the ED until the PIR so we could consider in the context of other issues. And I think I don't have suggestions that are as helpful as the ones that Sue and Daryl offered about the phrasing of this, but I'd like to make it both more specific and maybe narrower to reflect what it is that we've heard, and rather than trying to draft at the table, just ask the staff to pull this one in, because right now it suggests that we'd like to hear any views about reconsidering P times Q generically, which will bring up every issue with large positions that don't even begin to get to significant influence, rather than the much more limited issue that we have struggled with. So,
Greg Wong.
No, I agree with staff's proposal to take the four issues. Again, as to the fifth one about biological assets and even equities and the inactive market or unquoted market, I still feel it not only how to do it. I personally feel Mariana prepare education materials for the unquoted instruments, and we discussed about 5 years ago. People will not say that document is not useful, but they will say it not useful is because the documents not solve the issues we have.
I don't disagree with you, but I think we've got two questions. The first one is, should we have it at all? And that's for IS 41 and others to answer, and we should make it clear that's not part of the mandate.
Yeah.
But I think there are also issues with how to. And I think we need to then ask with that how to, whether there's something in the standard that creates the uncertainty. I think we need to be asking the question. And say, particularly, it seems to me it jumps out a lot when the asset is part of another asset. And the one part is fair value and the other is not part. And I'm not sure we have covered that sufficiently clearly in the standard. And then the second issue is guidance, is education. And I think we need to ask perhaps whether that education that we worked on a couple of years ago was useful. What we ended up producing was a textbook, and I'm not sure that was entirely what people thought they were looking for. And if we are going to develop education, what kind of education is useful? Or perhaps whether we should be encouraging others. I think that is a question we should answer so that we get a directed outcome. We can understand what to do with the outcome.
All right. Well, I think the staff has enough to go on. We thank the staff for an excellent series of papers that were very clear indeed, and we had a good discussion as a result. I think going forward, the discussion indicates it's very important to make clear that the scope of this exercise will be IFRS 13 and nothing else.
So, can we just confirm that everyone is in agreement then with that conclusion?
Did you?
Kind of questions one through
three collectively.
I mean, if I just quickly summarise what I heard we are going to do now after this.
Well, didn't you already do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessary.
Okay.
And do we agree with questions one through three?
Is question two amended to include the fifth item or not?
It will include, are we going to do the education aspect, the how-to? I think so, yes.
I think I took that away as that is going to be added to the
four plus.
Questions.
Yep.
Four plus.
Yes.
So that's 4+.
All in favour now?
Yeah.
Way go. You're not in favour?
I want to emphasise. I don't agree with 4+
type of conclusion. In my view, biological assets, I emphasize again and again, and the unquoted equity, is not only the educational material issue.
We know that, but it's not the scope of this PIR.
Those are different standards.
It's not a PIR of 13 to start doing that.
What does plus mean?
Plus means?
Do people need help with the how to do the measurement, which we know doesn't fully address your issue?
I would rather prefer not put the half.
Okay.
You know,
so because you ignore the how to.
Like
so you ignore the how to.
No. How to is an issue, but then another aspect, that is whether it provides relevant information.
I agree that the question is not whether that provides relevant information that is not in the scope. I don't have an issue with that. But I think if we raise the issue, having already identified that it is just a question of education, in a way we preempt people from addressing the issues that they encounter in practice in the how-to more broadly. So I think we still need, before we can identify the solutions that are appropriate and that are largely based on education, that we don't know yet, I think we should be open in learning what are the difficulties that are encountered in practice.
Yes, which I think we're
so not preempting what the solution is.
Yes.
11 in favour.
Okay, we take a break till 11:15.